Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dan Vicuña, National Redistricting Manager with Common Cause, who talks about new evidence that exposes the Trump administration lies on their motive for including a citizenship question in the 2020 census. Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with People for the American Way, who discusses why her group believes it's important that former Special Counsel Robert Mueller testify before Congress about the details of his investigation. And Alok Bhatt of the Connecticut Immigrant Rights Alliance, who explains how a coalition of progressive groups strengthen a state law protecting undocumented immigrants from ICE arrest and deportation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Citing emergency powers, the Trump administration authorized $8 billion in new arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, bypassing congressional review. The emergency order was also used to authorize the deployment of 1,500 more U.S. troops to the Middle East in response to rising tensions with Iran. Resistance to Saudi arms sales has grown on Capitol Hill in response to the worsening humanitarian crisis in Yemen and to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's involvement in the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a columnist for The Washington Post. The four-year-long Saudi-led war in Yemen has destroyed half of the Arab nation's health clinics, left an estimated 70,000 people dead and over 3 million displaced. During the conflict, major U.S. arms manufacturers, including Raytheon, General Dynamics, Boeing, and Lockheed Martin, have won $30 billion in contracts prior to the Trump emergency order. According to In These Times magazine, U.S. law prohibits arms sales to nations that indiscriminately kill civilians, as the Saudi-led bombing of Yemen has in several documented cases. Riding a wave of young supporters, the Green Party made unexpected gains in elections for the European Parliament, as established centre-right and centre-left parties, including Social Democrats in Germany, faltered. The Greens came in second in Germany and increased their vote across Western Europe in France, the UK, Luxembourg and Finland. However, the Greens made little progress in southern and eastern European nations. The issue of climate change is now driving the Green Party agenda in Europe, boosted by weekly massive Fridays for the Future protests and by student climate strikes inspired by Swedish teenage activist Greta Thunberg. In France, the Greens were the top vote-getter among voters 25 and younger, outpacing the far-right party of Marine Le Pen and the centrist party of President Emmanuel Macron. In France, as elsewhere, the left seems not to have died, but merely to have changed form. To the extent that a muscular leftist movement exists, it is now green. Following the vote, French Green Party leader Yannick Jadot told French TV, "The Greens represent the only project of the future." US government researchers have found high levels of radiation in clams in the Marshall Islands, a former nuclear weapons test site during the 1940s and 1950s. A nuclear cleanup of the area, including the Eniwetok Atoll, was undertaken in the late 1970s, and waste was buried in a giant containment vessel known as the Tomb. The findings from the Marshall Islands suggest that radiation is either leaking from the waste site, which US officials reject, or that authorities did not adequately clean up radiation left behind from past weapons testing, as some in the Marshall Islands claim. There are growing concerns that the contamination is spreading from the dump site's tainted groundwater into the ocean and the food chain, yet there are no signs posted warning the island's residents of the health danger. From 1946 to 1958, the US tested 67 nuclear devices in the Marshall Islands. In a 377-foot deep crater created by a nuclear bomb blast, groundwater radiation is 1,000 to 6,000 times higher than in the open ocean. Lucinda Anatok, 35, of Cedro Woolley, Washington, a descendant of a Marshall Island landowner, said the U.S. testing program in Eniwetok had devastated her family. Her grandmother, who was raised on Eniwetok, had thyroid cancer. Her mother, who was born there, had cervical cancer, and her sister had leukemia. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Since 2017, the Trump administration has been pushing to include a question on citizenship in the 2020 U.S. Census, claiming that its inclusion would help them better enforce the Voting Rights Act. But now new evidence has emerged that a Republican Party gerrymandering strategist had proposed the citizenship question because he determined it would clearly be a disadvantage to the Democrats and advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. The strategist Tom Hoefler, who died last year, left behind documents on computer hard drives directly related to his proposal to include the citizenship question, which were discovered by his estranged daughter and later introduced into evidence in a lawsuit challenging gerrymandered North Carolina state legislative districts drafted by Hoefler. Since being proposed, opponents have maintained that inclusion of the citizenship question would discourage many undocumented immigrants and their families from participating in the census, which would result in a population undercount nationwide, estimated to total between 4 and 6 million. A case challenging the citizenship question is currently before the U.S. Supreme Court, and the new evidence significantly contradicts the Trump administration's testimony in that case. Your reporter spoke with Dan Vicuna, National Redistricting Manager with Common Cause, who describes the importance of the newly discovered smoking gun evidence and how it may affect the Supreme Court's ruling in the census citizenship question case.
Common Cause is the plaintiff in a couple of different lawsuits challenging partisan gerrymandering. One was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court challenging North Carolina congressional districts. We're awaiting a decision on that, which has huge implications for the question of whether partisan gerrymandering is constitutional. However, we're also the plaintiffs in a state lawsuit in state court challenging North Carolina state legislative districts as a violation of the North Carolina Constitution. That is still has been in the discovery stage where we're gathering evidence, interviewing potential witnesses, taking depositions. It'll go to trial in next month. And in the process of sort of discovery for that trial, We came in contact with Stephanie Hoefler, the daughter of a now deceased man named Thomas Hoefler, who really was a top-level practitioner of the dark arts of gerrymandering for Republicans around the country. She was calling sort of about a different matter, just saw Common Cause as a sort of a trusted organization, wanted to had some questions sort of about legal representation and some other matters and thought we might have some insight. But in a back-and-forth discussion with one of our staffers in North Carolina, she mentioned that she had what sounded like sort of a treasure trove of documents, of her father's documents, related to that work, gerrymandering across the country. So she was willing to give those to us to see if we could uncover some information about how districts were manipulated across the country. And in sorting through that that evidence, we came across something we didn't expect, which was not only related to sort of the gerrymandering of North Carolina's maps directly, but also related to his role in the inclusion of the citizenship question in the census. And what we determined was that he was asked to do a study on who would benefit, if a citizenship question was added, whether that would benefit Republicans. The study was paid for by a conservative kind of mega donor, and he found that in fact adding such a question would therefore allow states to draw districts not on the basis of total population, which has been the way that the Constitution demands, the way that it's been done since the beginning of the Republic, but instead to limit the count to just citizens, which would, of course, have a huge impact on how different communities and states are counted. He showed that it would, as he put it, create a structural electoral advantage for us, he put it, quote, Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. That logic ended up in front of basically through a Trump administration official that Dr. Hoefler was in contact with. That logic, that argument, made its way to the Department of Justice, the Trump administration Department of Justice, which then requested the inclusion of a citizenship question to the Commerce Department. Now, all along, the Department of Justice, the Trump administration, has been making the laughable claim that their goal in including the citizenship question was to better enforce the Voting Rights Act. If there's been an administration more hostile to people of color in the modern era, it would be harder to find. So the notion that they would be using this question to help people of color more effectively exercise their right to vote is ridiculous. However, we sort of intuitively knew that as a voting rights community. But this is the first time we see a direct line from a study showing that a citizenship question would hurt Latino communities, help whites and Republicans, to its actual inclusion by the Commerce Department.
Dan, I wondered if you would tell us a bit about how this evidence could affect the Supreme Court decision, which is pending right now. I believe a Supreme Court decision is expected by the end of June after they heard arguments in April. What is your best guess as to the justices considering this new evidence in the ruling that they will likely make in a few weeks?
It's hard to say. So you're right that there's currently a decision pending in this case brought by the ACLU and State of New York. At the trial court, the plaintiffs challenging the inclusion of the citizenship question won on all counts. The trial court issued a clear opinion that this was wrong and that the federal government broke the law on the inclusion of this question. But, however, the Supreme Court, at least in initial oral arguments, it seemed like some of the conservative justices were very amenable to the government's position. In fact, I think the Chief Justice may have repeated the claim about Trump administration's sort of argument that they needed to include the question to enforce the Voting Rights Act. The plaintiffs filed a motion with the Supreme Court alerting them to this new evidence. It is late in the term. It's late, but hopefully not too late. I mean, it would be sort of a willful blindness to not look at this smoking gun evidence that the government was just not telling the truth about why they were including this question. So I'm hoping, despite this late stage, that it can have some impact on one or two votes in the Supreme Court. It just seems too difficult to ignore.
That was Dan Vicuña, National Redistricting Manager with Common Cause. Learn more about the new evidence that reveals the Trump administration's true motivation to include the citizenship question in the 2020 census by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After a 2+ year investigation and the recent release of a redacted version of his 448-page probe into Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, Special Counsel Robert Mueller broke his silence and provided the nation with a televised summary of his report's conclusions, which directly contradicted a summary issued earlier by Trump-appointed Attorney General William Barr. In his 9-minute talk, Mueller made several important points about his investigation. He pointedly stated, quote, "If we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so," unquote. And he went on to explain that Justice Department policy prevented him from moving to indict a sitting president. However, Mueller did not call on Congress to exercise its constitutional power to hold the president accountable in an impeachment inquiry for the possible crimes Mueller stated he could not prosecute. Now, House Democrats and activist groups across the country are calling on Mueller to testify before Congress, despite the former special counsel's insistence that he would not provide any additional information about the Russia investigation beyond the information already contained in his report. Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, executive vice president with the group People for the American Way. Here she explains why many believe it's important that Mueller testify before Congress about the details of his investigation and also comments on the current debate over whether or not the House should initiate a Trump impeachment inquiry.
People need to know what's in the report, and they're not going to pay attention to what's in the report by reading it. They're going to pay attention to what's in the report by hearing Mueller talk about what's in the report. And even if he goes no further than what's in the report, there's still numerous lines of questioning that he will be asked. Even those lines of questions are ways of sort of creating a narrative about, well, you know, making it clear his differences in significant respects from Barr's interpretation of the law and the Constitution and in what way a current sitting president can be held accountable. But what's most important is actually getting the American public, giving them an opportunity to hear and see and watch this man's demeanor and understand how thorough the report is. If he all he did was testify about what's in the report is absolutely damning.
What are the specific areas that you would like both the House and Senate committees to ask Mueller about? What needs the most clarification in your view?
There's two things. There are clearly, I mean, the report has 10 different potential instances of obstruction, and I think some of the most important ones have to do with attempts to fire Mueller and then try to get people to, for example, Don McGahn, to lie about whether he tried to fire Mueller. There were significant attempts to limit the Mueller investigation by getting Sessions to unrecuse himself and get back in the game, or limit the Mueller investigation to just future interference in elections. And there's potential witness tampering in terms of the president's efforts to influence Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort in particular. Those are just sort of the tip of the iceberg. So there are actual discrete instances discussed in the report, laid out in the report, that talk about Trump's efforts to undermine the investigation. And that's extremely important. Volume 1 of the report talks about the extensive efforts by Russia to interfere with the elections. And although Mueller did not find that there was an effort by Trump to coordinate with the Russians on that, it was very clear from the report that Trump knew what was going on. His folks knew what was going on. They didn't do anything about it. They didn't go to the FBI. They were happy to receive the benefit of what the Russians were doing because it was going to help him win the election. And that's really important. That's really important, both in terms of understanding what happened during the election, but also understanding what are these relationships that are even now potentially influencing our foreign policy and national security efforts. So I think both areas need exposure, need public exposure, need the public to understand, and having Mueller testify in both of these areas would be extremely enlightening.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and her House leadership have for months now backed off on the question of impeachment out of fear, we hear, of a backlash and energizing Trump's base of support. They feel, and they've articulated their argument, that going after impeachment could be a dead end because 2/3 of the Senate will likely not convict Trump of articles of impeachment, and therefore he won't be removed from office. And Nancy Pelosi and the other leaders of the House basically say, our only recourse and our strongest suit to make sure Trump doesn't come into a second term is to focus like crazy on the election in November 2020.
Yeah, so I think number one, I think it's hard to sit here in, you know, June 2019 and try to figure out what June 2020 is going to look like, right? And so I think it is really, really important to be focusing on kitchen table issues because that is ultimately what the sort of lawlessness and corruption are doing, is it's leaving us without an ability to have, you know, a government that cares about health care and cares about climate and cares about our ability to have safe and secure elections and all of that. But I also think this is taking on a life of its own. The lawlessness and corruption and the extent of that are so huge that there's no question it has to be investigated. And as it gets investigated and as the public gets more aware, we will start seeing this momentum change. And I would bet that it's quite possible by June 2020 that the people who will be hurt by not holding this administration accountable are not the Democrats, the Republicans who are enabling this administration. And that will be true in both Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate. And so I think we just have to understand where we are. We are in a moment. We are in virtually a constitutional crisis. We have no choice. But we have to continue exposing what's going on and exposing the lawlessness and corruption and understanding how that is totally undermining the government serving the people. The government is not serving the people. The government is serving the interest of Donald Trump. And that's not what democracy is about. I just think this is the time when Congress needs to use every single tool at its disposal to hold this administration accountable and to hold this administration's enablers accountable, including opening an impeachment inquiry if necessary. This is where we are, and it's the constitutional framework that we have. Fundamentally, Mueller said, based on the OLC opinion, the Office of Legal Counsel opinion, Department of Justice, that you can't indict a sitting president and you can't charge a sitting president. So Mueller clearly said, this is in Congress's hands. Congress has to step up and do that investigation. What's important is getting the story out, because when the American people understand the story, they will not accept what's going on. So that's the most important thing. Fundamental issue is that our democratic process, our Constitution, provides ways to get that story out, and that's what we need to do.
That was Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with People for the American Way. For more analysis and commentary on the debate over initiating an impeachment inquiry into President Trump's misconduct, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On May 30th, the Connecticut General Assembly strengthened previously passed legislation known as the Trust Act, which was originally signed into law in 2013 to provide greater protection for undocumented immigrants in the state from federal deportation. Several immigrant rights groups, along with the Working Families Party of Connecticut, Planned Parenthood of Southern New England, and 32BJ SEIU, the Office Cleaners and Food Service Workers Union, built a coalition that was able to eliminate five of the seven exceptions to protection under the 2013 Trust Act legislation. The revisions incorporated into two separate bills helps prevent undocumented immigrants from being deported if they seek assistance from police or other state agencies. Passage of the improved Trust Act places Connecticut at the forefront of states valuing the contributions of immigrants and helping to keep families together. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with the Locke Bott, Community Defense Coordinator with the Connecticut Immigrant Rights Alliance. Here he explains how his coalition succeeded in passing the bill and what still remains to be done to match the protections for immigrants that have been signed into law in several other states.
The 2013 Trust Act wasn't very comprehensive. I think we were the first state in the nation to pass a law like that on the state level, but it definitely, like other states have done it progressively better than we did. Like we kind of set a pretty low precedent. What the original Trust Act from 2013 does, it basically limits circumstances in which state and local law enforcement can honor detainer requests for ICE. And it didn't really require a judicial warrant. It just like limited the circumstances. Like one of the significant problems with that Trust Act was it left seven really wide exemptions. So it was like categories that would disqualify people from the Trust Act's protections. If you had like a prior removal, like so if someone was deported before and came back, which many people who have families here do, because most people would do anything to reunite with their families. If you had like an outstanding warrant, it had like a really wide like public safety, like officer discretion loophole. So it was basically a situation where in a lot of cases, the exceptions were swallowing the rule. And another really significant problem with the 2013 Trust Act was that within the law, there was a section that mandated state or local law enforcement agents to notify ICE of their decision to either release or detain an individual. So even if they released an individual, they would still be calling ICE and notifying ICE that they're releasing that individual, kind of in a way facilitating ICE's arrest. And so just over the years, we are seeing, particularly, I think, during the escalation in immigration enforcement under this new federal administration or the current federal administration, the Trust Act was becoming somewhat effective in like some ways. It was in a lot of ways becoming obsolete. And we wanted to make sure that we had a state law that could work for the people in protecting their rights. And so that's why people felt and the community felt very strongly that we needed to update the Trust Act in 2013.
Alok Bhatt, you know only a fraction of bills that are introduced make it through the process. How did your coalition succeed in getting this updated Trust Act passed?
I think this year, much more so in previous years, the level of like support and organizing on the ground was much more significant. We had community members coming out strong to deliver written and spoken testimony before the Judiciary Committee when the bill was still sitting in committee during the public hearing. We had a pretty significant social media campaign, including video testimonies from members of our community. One testimony in particular, I think, really inspired Representative Stephen Stastrom, who's the Democratic House co-chair of the Judiciary Committee from Bridgeport. Make the Road to Connecticut, which has an office in Bridgeport, had a community meeting in which some of their members spoke about how probation officers called ICE on a father and husband in the community. So sharing stories like that via video with a really crack film team really helped spread the stories and the messages and really highlight the human element of this and really kind of breaking through the rhetoric to kind of giving folks, I think, a more intimate insight into what immigration enforcement with the collaboration of state and local authorities really looks like and how it has a direct impact in communities. Yeah, I think just like the multiple levels of like community support and like active components in the campaign, as far as doing community education, social media, like really strong lobbying campaign with folks doing a lot of phone calls and letter writing. I think all of that really, really helped culminate into a successful campaign this year.
Five of the exceptions to protection under the 2013 law were eliminated, including the one that affected the most people, being immigrants with a final deportation order. But I know you didn't get everything you wanted, so what exceptions are still in this updated version?
Well, there was a separate bill that amended Senate Bill 992, which basically enables state or local law enforcement agents to either arrest or detain someone on behalf of ICE, with or without a warrant, if those individuals have A or B level felony conviction in the state, or if that individual is on the terrorist watch list.
Does passage of this bill put Connecticut back on top of states with better protections for undocumented immigrants?
Unfortunately, no. I think California and Illinois have laws that prohibit ICE holds altogether absent a judicial warrant. So we're up there. I mean, I would say maybe we're like top five, but we'll definitely be back to fix it. You know, we will do want to continue fighting until we can make sure that we're able to get ICE out of Connecticut effectively.
That was Alok Bhatt with the Connecticut Immigrant Rights Alliance. Learn more about Connecticut's recently passed legislation to protect immigrants from aggressive ICE deportation policy dictated by the Trump administration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Global Community Radio in Geneva, New York, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.